and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
On the road again, just can't wait to get on the road again. Life I love is making music with my friends, and I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again, going places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again, and I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again, like a band of gypsies, we go down the highway. We're the best of friends, insisting that the world keep turning our way. And our way is on the road again. I just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends, and I can't wait to get on the road again. I sang that to you tonight because I am on the road in Philadelphia. Well, near Philadelphia now. I'm with friends I haven't seen in 30 or 40 years and having fun. Even if they did all desert me to go visit with someone else while I do the show. Oh, well. It did help me get all set up to talk to you tonight, and I really do appreciate that. You know, this is the first time I've been outside of Florida since the 90s. Wow. Too long to not, you know, too long to be away from traveling. Really fun. I'm having a great time, but I miss Lorraine. Here's a shout out to Lorraine and Lucy, who may or may not be listening down there in Fort Lauderdale, but I'm going to shout out to them anyway. And one of the really cool things I've done while I'm up here in Philly is ride bikes all over the place. They have a bike share program. It's reasonably priced, worth every penny. You pay, you know, one thing for the month, and then you pick it up one place, you drop it off someplace else, walk around, have something to eat, whatever, pick up another one, drop it off somewhere else, pick up another one, drop. Well, I'll tell you, over the couple days, three days, two and a half days, whatever I've been here, I think I took 16 or maybe 18 bike rides, anywhere from six minutes to about an hour. And it's just been great. It's more cities need to have programs like this and decent public transportation. I can't say enough about the public transportation infrastructure up here. Buses on just about every street. They go by just every few minutes. Nobody's having to wait a long time. You know, in Fort Lauderdale, you miss the bus, you're stuck for an hour. Up here, maybe 10 minutes, maybe 15. It's just really fun to be here. Weren't so cold, I think about moving. Oh, well, way too cold for me. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show. And we're streaming live to you on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And I'd like to remind you, it's listener-supported radio. And if you have a chance to hop over there to freedomslips.com and buy something from them, to support not only our show, but plethora of very good shows to go out on two different studio streams, very close to 24 hours a day. And now, I am proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Sherwood Ross, Ole Damigard, Mickey Z, and Phil Ferruggio. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, actually Philadelphia, Duluth, Coral Gables, Port Orange, somewhere in Spain, Queens, Astoria, New York City, and wherever you are. We continue with our miniseries regarding A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America. It's a book. The culmination of all this is Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett and the False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio every Thursday. They are the evolved media. We know that today's newspapers, radio, and TV are garbage, as well as the current version of what passes for alternative media, The Nation, The Progressive, NPR, Alternate, Rachel Maddow, Goodman, Jon Stewart. If not garbage, at least suspicious, very suspicious. But what we want to do is to say something in this miniseries about the history of the alternative press, the beginnings that have evolved into Fetzer and Barrett. More from the book by David Armstrong. The most popular radical publication of any kind in American history was a weekly newspaper published in Girard, Kansas, called Appeal to Reason. Issued from 1895 to 1917, the Appeal survived without subsidy from wealthy backers, heavy advertising, or support from a political party by offering a lively, easy-to-read editorial mix. Edited by J.A. Wayland, who wrote most of the early editions himself, the Appeal published frequent contributions from Eugene Debs and Upton Sinclair. In 1905, the Appeal serialized Sinclair's classic, The Jungle, a year before it was published in book form. The Masses, a monthly magazine published in New York, was a sophisticated urban contemporary of the Appeal, published from 1911 to 1917 in the heady avant-garde atmosphere of pre-World War I Greenwich Village. The Masses attempted to fuse politics with art and was surprisingly successful. The magazine's ambitious philosophy was spelled out on its masthead. A revolutionary and not a reform magazine, a magazine with no dividends to pay, a free magazine, frank, arrogant, searching for the true causes, a magazine directed against rigidity and dogma whenever it is found, printing what is too naked or true for a money-making press, a magazine whose final policy is to do as it pleases and conciliate nobody, not even its readers. There is room for this publication in America. Brilliantly edited by Max Eastman, the Masses drew upon first-rate contributors such as Sherwood Anderson, Floyd Dale, and John Reed, author of the classic history of the Russian Revolution, 10 Days That Shook the World. The Masses strongly opposed World War I as a rich man's war, and in one cartoon depicted Christ being shot as a deserter. The Masses' second-class mailing privileges were revoked, along with those of 50 other radical periodicals, including Appeal to Reason, The Industrial Workers of the World's Industrial Worker, and Emma Goldman's anarchist magazine, Mother Earth. The Masses' editors were tried twice under the Espionage Act for allegedly harming recruiting efforts with their anti-war propaganda. They were acquitted both times, but the wave of repression finally swamped the Masses. With its demise came the end of a freewheeling era of press eclecticism that would not return until the underground media explosion of the 60s, an explosion that engendered its own wave of repression. From A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America, continuing next week. And speaking of real journalism, check out Luke Rutkowski confronts Anderson Cooper. Have you ever heard of Operation Mockingbird? See this at memoryholeblog.com.
And now for the Target and Walmart, Lori Berenson, Julia Butterfly Hill, Dorothy Day, Emma Goldman, Mother's Day card collection. A card designed with you in mind. Julia Butterfly Hill. We live in a world that tells us not to care, to consume everything in sight. It tells us that being cool and being an individual actually means buying what everyone else is buying and doing what everyone else is doing. If you're the only person left, as long as your hope is committed in action, then hope is alive in the world. When you see someone in a tree trying to protect it, you know that every level of our society has failed. The consumers have failed. The companies have failed. The government has failed.
Emma Goldman, I'd rather have roses on my table than diamonds on my neck. The higher mental development of a woman, the less possible it is for her to meet a congenial male who will see in her not only sex, but also the human being, the friend, the comrade, and strong individuality who cannot and ought not lose a single trait of her character. Women think with their whole bodies, and they see things as a whole more than men do.
Dorothy Day. As Dostoevsky said, love in action is a harsh and dreadful thing. compared with love and dreams.
Lori Berenson, I think it's in young people's hands to learn about things, to question what makes no sense, to remember that the world is much bigger, much more beautiful than the frontiers of the U.S., and that the U.S. isn't America. America is two continents, from Canada to the southern cone of Argentina and Chile. The American continents are part of a big and beautiful world that we will wind up destroying if we don't look to change the way we relate to one another and to the world itself. I'd say read, inquire, doubt, investigate, dream, but don't sit still and don't believe that just because the U.S. is the most powerful country on the globe right now, that everything it did to become so was right, and that everything it does to remain as such is also right. Human values, brotherly love, and solidarity are more important than greed. There's a lot to do if this world is to continue functioning. Please do something to make it a better place.
Target and Walmart, Lori Berenson, Julia Butterfly Hill, Dorothy Day, Emma Goldman, Mother's Day card collection are designed with you in mind. Oh, what a perfect day in a perfect town in a perfect house on the perfect side of the street. It's another episode of Sitting on the Floor at Ward Cleaver's Feet, listening to Ward Cleaver. Ward Cleaver speaks. Remember the peace dividend? They didn't want peace. Remember the first fake World Trade Center bombing? That was our baptism to fear Muslims. The Patriot Act, anthrax, Wellstone, the Department of Homeland Security, modeled on the East German Stasi. A lot of thought has gone into all of this, Beaver. Manifest Destiny, the American Century, American Exceptionalism, Globalization, or, as Madeleine Albright put it, the Indispensable Nation, while others less kind have used the term imperialist. I, oh my, such webs of deception these spiders weave. Sandy Hook can be ripped open for total exposure to the germicidal light of sunshine. This can only tear asunder numbers of other episodes of total lawless corruption. Once started, this tornado won't stop until it lands at the foot of the real guilty parties. Beave. Let me tell you, there's nothing like the smell of noosed corpses dancing in the dappled light of morning. Oh, what a perfect day in a perfect town in a perfect house on the perfect side of the street, sitting on the floor at Ward Cleaver's feet, listening. And the Daughters of the New American Revolution are presenting a free showing of that new movie, The Plowshares Movement, more patriotic than all your phony military crap, by Ken Burns, Tom Hanks, and Doris Kearns Goodwin. A preview. In 1980, several members of the Atlantic Life community carried out the first Plowshares action, symbolically disarming MX missiles by hammering their nose cones the General Electric facility in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. The subsequent trial involved 8 defendants: Philip Berrigan, Daniel Berrigan, S.J., Carl Cabot, O.M.I., John Schuchart, Dean Hammer, Elmer Moss, Ann Montgomery, R.C.S.J., and Molly Rush. The group's name had been suggested by these lines from Old Testament prophet Isaiah, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. By 2006, 80 plowshares groups unfurling banners on warships and pouring blood on plans for other peacekeepers had entered various weapons facilities along the East Coast from Maine to Florida, throughout the Midwest and Southwest, in England, Ireland, Scotland, Germany, and Australia. On Easter Sunday, 1991, at 3:45 a.m., for example, five Aegis plowshares, Kathy Boylan, Tom Lewis, Barry Ross, Philip Berrigan, and Daniel Sicken, climbed onto the USS Gettysburg, harbored at Bath, Maine, hammered on missile launchers, poured blood and unfurled banners across the gunwale. They also posted an indictment charging President Bush and other military chiefs with violations of religious, domestic, and international law in deploying weapons of mass destruction, such as the. Similarly, in April 2002, three Dominican nuns, sisters Carol Gilbert, Jackie Hudson, and Ardeth Platt, symbolically disarmed a nuclear missile silo in color. The most recent plowshares action, the Transform Now plowshares, Sister Megan Rice, Michael Wally, and Greg Borchi, were convicted of sabotage at the Oak Ridge Nuclear Weapons Complex and sentenced to 62 months in federal prison. Please come out to the Legion Hall, buy an apple pie, and support the Daughters of the New American Revolution.
Our first guest of the evening is Ole Damegaard. As Chuck gets Ole lined up, I'll read a little bit of his bio, and I'll stop when it comes on. He is a prize-winning author, investigator, former journalist. For more than 30 years, he worked very hard on solving the mystery behind the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, something that has turned out
well,
to be a very dangerous
Well, this week, we welcome back to the show, Ole Damegaard. We've missed him the last month or two. We had a little bit of trouble connecting, but we're back. He's back. And, Ole, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. Folks, we're going to do a little disconnect, reconnect, because I understand that this may not be going out. Bear with us.
I'll read some more of Ole's bio real quickly.
Be disconnecting the signal, Mike, and trying
okay,
again.
Chuck, I can just hear noises. I can't really make out what Ole is saying. Ole's bio continues, not only do I humbly believe that I've now managed to solve one of the century's biggest murder mysteries, my extensive research has also revealed incredible links to other big political events like the killing of JFK, John Lennon, Robert Kennedy, Che Guevara, Salvador Allende, Pablo Neruda, and many others, as well as the cold-blooded sinking of the Estonia, taking almost 1,000 innocent lives. I have made hundreds of international radio interviews on stations like Red Ice, The People's Voice, Project Camelot, No Lies from the Real Deal, which has caused a tidal wave of international interest. I am totally dedicated to revealing the New World Order's agenda, including false flag operations all over the world. It is important for me to point out that I'm not here to spread fear by exposing the truth in whatever form it takes. My goal is to prevent the so-called global elite from turning this beautiful world into a scary, controlled, and fearful place. We all deserve so much better. It's time to stop the madness. Chuck, how's it going there?
Well, I don't know. This when we tried this earlier, you heard it just fine, and now you don't hear it for some reason. I'm trying to do a little troubleshooting. Why don't you just go ahead?
Just a little on the Kevin Barrett, and I talked about Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer before, And if you could, I try and plug them as much as I can, and because I think they are really the, we do the best we can, but I think Fetzer and Barrett are really the cutting edge of American journalism, and I mean that sincerely. I think that there are others who are really helping and do a kind of a commendable job, but it's really Fetzer and Barrett who you need to hear. And you hear them every Thursday on No Lies Radio, the False Flag Weekly News. And if you would go there, just click on the archives. And I was just listening to this week's show before we came on, as I was getting ready for this show, and they were talking about several things. Sometimes they have a half hour show, sometimes an hour show. And this show in part was about the Jade Helm exercises. And it's kind of interesting that Jim and Kevin are disagreeing pretty strongly about what Jade Helm is all about. And if you haven't heard, Jade Helm is a military exercise taking place now, I guess, in Texas. Supposed to go full force, I believe, in July 15th, but it's happening right now. And Jim thinks it is a full blown martial law exercise that is going to go live, or has gone live, or is real. And Kevin, for now, says that it's just he just doesn't see that it's that that's true, that it's not an actual exercise, that it's just a military drill, as they've been calling it. But it is, regardless, it's good to hear the opposing viewpoints and to decide for yourself. And what's really cool, I think, is that these two guys disagree and they keep going, though. They keep going with their weekly show, and sometimes they really get, really get excited, and that's good. And then you don't just split up and break and say, forget it. They just keep going. I think that's just outstanding. And I just recommend very much that show. And also, Kevin has other interview shows, and Jim does too. They just go to Radio Fetzer. You can find his shows, or go to No Lies Radio, and you can find Kevin's shows. And I just think that, along with James Tracy, they are just the cutting edge interviewers and also commentators. And they also find the persons that are most interested in. And Chuck, do you want to go ahead and try that now? Chuck says that he has Oli lined up for us. Can you get it online for us there, Chuck?
I don't think there's actually enough time left.
But we only have
3 minutes. And
Chuck, can we just try it? We do have 5 minutes. We can get some of Oli in there if you can get it called up.
Okay, we'll try.
Yep. Again, we hear every month from Oli. He's in Spain. I don't know the county.
Oh, Oli Domingar. We've missed him the last month or two. We had a little bit of trouble connecting, but we're back. He's back. And Ole, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. Well, I'm not sure if Ole's recording was getting through to you folks, but he was having some things to say about the Holocaust, and in particular the gas chambers, and maybe we'll get a chance to let you hear it some other time. I just cut it loose so I could apologize to you for the, once again, technical difficulties, but we will keep on trying, and we'll get it right next time.
Chuck, thanks for trying. Yep, we'll try it again. Sometimes those things happen. We have again received word from Randall from Stevens Point. He says, I got my gun in my truck. I told you I'm heading for the woods, not the mountain. That's where I am right now. I can see y'all from right here through my scope. Don't worry. I got the safety on. Okay. It's on now. Tell Bubba Jean I always loved her. Don't follow me. I got on my camo jeans. You'd never find me. When you hear about the big shootout and all that, then that'll be me. Randall from Stevens Point is now underground in America. Before he gets started, he wanted us to again relay this message. First, I got something to say to my relatives in Baraboo. I'm not really talking to any of you because you know why. Randall's note continues. It does not matter to the corporate rich who wins the presidential election. It does not matter who is elected to Congress. The rich have the power. They throw money at their favorites the way a gambler puts cash on his favorite horse. Money has replaced the vote. The wealthy can crush anyone who does not play by their rules. And the political elite slobbering over the spoils provided by their corporate masters for selling us out understand the game. Barack and Michelle Obama, as did the Clintons, will acquire many millions of dollars once they leave the White House. And your elected representative in the House or Senate, if not a multimillionaire already, will be one as soon as he or she retires from government and has handed seats on corporate boards or positions in lobbying firms. We do not live in a democracy. We live in a political system that has legalized bribery, exclusively serves corporate power, and is awash in propaganda and lies. If you want to change the system, if you want change you can believe in, destroy the system.
And changing the system does not mean collaborating with it, as Bernie Sanders is doing by playing by the cooked rules of the Democratic Party. Profound social and political transformation is acknowledged in legislatures and courts, but never initiated there. Radical change always comes from below. As long as our gaze is turned upward to the powerful, as long as we invest hope in reforming the system of corporate power, we will remain enslaved. There may be good people within the system. Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are examples. But that is not the point. It is the system that is rotten. It must be replaced. Only by building militant mass movements that are unrelentingly hostile to the system of corporate capitalism, imperialism, militarism, and globalization can we wrest back our democracy.
We have to organize around a series of non-negotiable demands. We have to dismantle the array of mechanisms the rich use to control power. We have to destroy the ideological and legal system cemented into place to justify corporate plunder. This is called revolution. It is about ripping power away from a cabal of corporate oligarchs and returning it to the citizenry. This will happen not by appealing to corporate power, but by terrifying it. And power, as we saw in Baltimore, will be terrified only when we take to the streets. There is no other way.
The rich are only defeated when running for their lives, the historian C.L.R. James noted. And until you see the rich fleeing in panic from the halls of Congress, the temples of finance, the universities, the media conglomerates, the war industry, and their exclusive gated communities and private clubs, all politics in America will be farce. It is apparent to most people across the globe that organizing political and social behavior around the dictates of the marketplace has proved to be a disaster for working men and women. The promised prosperity that was to have raised living standards through trickle-down economics has been exposed as a lie. The corporate state, understanding that it has been unmasked with the rise of unrest, has formed militarized police forces, stripped us of legal protection, taken over the legislative bodies, the courts, and mass media, and built the most intrusive system of mass surveillance in human history.
Corporate power, if unchecked, will suck every last bit of profit out of human society and the ecosystem before collapse. It has no self-imposed limits. It has no external limits. Only we can create them. To save ourselves from impending financial and environmental catastrophe, we need to build movements that have as their uncompromising goal the abolition of corporate power. Corporation after corporation, including banks, energy companies, the healthcare sector, and defense contractors, must be broken up and nationalized.
We must institute a nationwide public works program, especially for those under the age of 25, to create conditions for full employment. We must mandate a $15 an hour minimum wage. We must slash our obscene spending on defense. We spend $610 billion a year, more than four times the outlay of the second largest military spender, China. Cut the size of our armed forces by more than half. We must rebuild our infrastructure, including mass transit, roads, bridges, schools, libraries, and public housing. We must make war on the fossil fuel industry and turn to alternative sources of energy. We must place heavy taxes on the rich, including a special tax on Wall Street speculators that would be used to wipe out the $1.3 trillion in student.
We must ensure that education at all levels, along with health care, is a free right of all Americans, not something accessible for the wealthy alone. We must abolish the Electoral College and mandate public financing of public political campaigns. We must see that the elderly, the disabled, poor single parents, and the mentally ill receive a weekly income of at least $600. We must find them space in state-run institutions if they require daily care. We must institute a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions.
We must end our wars and the proxy wars in the Middle East and bring home our soldiers, Marine, airmen, and sailors. We must pay reparations to Iraq and Afghanistan and to African Americans whose ancestors largely built this country as slaves who were never compensated for their labor. We must repeal the Patriot Act and Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. We must abolish the death penalty. We must dismantle our system of mass incarceration. Release the vast majority of our 2.3 million prisoners, place them in job skill programs, and find them work and housing. Police must be demilitarized. Mass surveillance must end. Undocumented workers must be given citizenship and full protection under the law. NAFTA, CAFTA, and other free trade agreements must be revoked. Anti-labor laws, such as the Taft-Hartley Act, along with laws that criminalize poverty and dissent, must be repealed.
All this is the minimum. Do not expect the corporate masters of war and commerce to willingly let this happen. They must be forced. Revolutions take time. They are often begun by one generation and completed by the next. Revolutions can be crushed by force, as amply demonstrated by history. Success is not assured, especially given the endemic levels of violence that have characterized American society.
But no matter what happens, the chain reaction that leads to revolt has begun. Most people realize that our expectations for a better future have been obliterated. Not only those for ourselves, but also for our children. This realization has lit the fuse. There's a widespread loss of faith in established systems of power. The will to rule is weakening among the elites who are entranced by hedonism and decadence. Internal corruption is rampant and transparent. Government is despised. The nation, like so many pre-revolutionary societies, is headed into crisis. When these state organs are ordered to carry out acts of repression, such as clearing people from parks, arresting or even shooting demonstrators, and refuse their orders, the old regime crumbles. The veneer of power appears untouched before a revolution, but the internal rot, unseen by the outside world, steadily hollows out the state edifice. When dying regimes collapse, they do so with dizzying speed. upheaval is coming. The people must be prepared. If we are, we will have a chance.
And now we hear from Andrei Vilcek. Andrei Vilcek is a novelist, philosopher, investigative journalist, filmmaker, photographer, and playwright. He has covered dozens of war zones and conflicts from Bosnia and Peru to Sri Lanka, Congo, and East Timor. He says, Albert Camus, a French philosopher, made one of the most important statements of the 20th century when he declared, "I rebel, therefore I exist." Rebellion is the engine that propels society and individuals forward. To take it away, to shut it off, means to condemn people and entire nations to stagnation, even to regression, which is, of course, the main goal of the empire, which is why it employs and grooms entire armies of local collaborators.
The empire created some amazing sights all over the world. Depressing, gore-filled scenes. For much of the planet is Halloween every day and every night. The West has many allies, many collaborators, bizarre bearded dudes with machine guns and portable missile launchers, decapitating infidels and blowing up the World Heritage Sites. That is what the empire has been trying painstakingly to turn Islam into, with full-hearted support of its deranged and blood-drenched allies in the Gulf. First, they murdered, sidelined, or overthrew progressive socialist Islam. Later, they manufactured the most fundamentalist brands from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. Bravo! Great success! As long as the oil flows, as long as the Western weapons are sold and defense budgets remain above $1 trillion, as long as there's always someone people can be told to be scared of, someone who can be used as a justification for new weaponry, new post-colonialist and imperialist arrangement of the world.
If a spaceship filled with advanced, refined, and objectively thinking beings coming from outer space would visit our planet, the visitors would be surely horrified by observing those individuals who are ruling such countries as Indonesia or Uganda or those in the Gulf. No Hollywood horror film could match the monsters that are ruling many corners of the globe, controlling, raping, robbing, and brainwashing their own people on behalf of the empire.
How many magazines, newspapers, and television stations in Italy, Southeast Asia, or East and West Africa are actually there to inform people? How many are serving dutifully the propaganda apparatus of level of collaboration with the West is scandalous. It is shocking. The most notorious forms of collaboration and spite toward the people can be found in what I lately call the Belt, which consists of the client states and semi-colonies spreading from Southeast Asia to East and West Africa, subcontinent, Middle East, in between. In that part of the world, countries that refuse to collaborate, Indonesia before 1965, Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Syria, Somalia, Congo under Patrice Lumumba, to name just a few, were muzzled, raped, destroyed, annihilated, leveled with the ground. In that belt, there is no shame left and no dignity. Intellectual cowardice, repulsive egoism, and servility in the countries like Malaysia or Indonesia are beyond obscene. They are grotesque, perverse. Artists and intellectuals say and write in film what is expected of them, what the West pays them to produce, and, of course, what sells.
From Andrei Vilcek. Follow him on Twitter at Andrei Vilcek, A-N-D-R-E-V-L-T-C-H-E-K. He can give us a unique and important view of the world. Our second guest of the evening is Sherwood Ross. And Chuck, I'll just read a little bit of this. Go ahead, and when I hear it ring, I'll stop. Chicago-born Sherwood Ross grew up in Miami. His father, an immigrant from Russia, was a wholesale liquor salesman, and his mother taught elementary school. Ross attended the University of Miami on a varsity debate team scholarship, where he majored in race relations and during his senior year earned money writing the weekly Vagabond 15-minute poetry show every Friday night on WTVJ-TV. Chuck, do we have Sherwood on yet? After graduation, 1955.
Sherwood.
Well, hello, Sherwood. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
I'd like to read a couple of poems tonight, and the first is called Sam, the Hardware King. I am a simple hardware man. My friends just call me Sam. I don't have to advertise. The trade knows who I am. Just by selling hardware, I've made myself a pile. When you come to Washington, I'll show you round in style. They call me Sam, because I'm the hardware king. Just call on Sam, I'll sell you anything. You will never sound retreat. Hey, I got prices they can't beat. Just call me Sam because I'm number one. Look at my list. I've every kind of gun. Before you shoot off another thing, drop in on Sam, the hardware king. Like the genie in the bottle, just give Sam a little rub. I've got underwater missiles you can shoot off from a sub. I've got bombs that fall in clusters. I've got germs that poison rice. Since they crawl out of their vials, I am selling them half price. You know, I still got Huey choppers left over from that war. Field guns they did not capture in my warehouse by the door. I've got infrared devices, shoot your enemies while they sleep. Fry them with flamethrowers, the asbestos gloves come cheap. I got bullets by the billions, I got portable latrines. For advice on their assembly, I'll throw in a few Marines. I got bombs that make a pattern when they burst like a geranium. And if you're a favored nation, I can slip you some uranium. My sales force is impartial. I'll take anybody's buck. All that you've got to know is when to shoot and when to duck. We'll sell to Africans and Afghans, to Muslims and the Jews, an equal opportunity defender. There's nobody we refuse. I've got owner-driven transport, tires with brand new tread. The owners absolutely love them. Too bad that now they're dead. I've got some unused missiles and a carload, not a gremlin. So accurate, I guarantee, they'll hit the men's room in the Kremlin. They call me Sam because I'm the hardware king. Just call on Sam, I'll show you anything. You will never sound retreat. I got prices they can't beat. Just call me Sam because I'm number one. Look at my list of every kind of gun. Before you shoot off another thing, drop in on Sam, the hardware king. Well, time maybe for a couple of love poems. When you live in Florida, you love the beach, and sand and water have a way of creeping into my poetry. This first poem is called Once. Once upon a memory when I loved you and you loved me and we lived among the roses in the cottage by the sea, in the cottage by the sounding sea. Beneath the opaque moon where the ocean turned to purple in the darkling afternoon. Once upon a memory, we ran along the sea, marveling at the starfish and the sea anemone. We ran on and on for miles until there was no light. Only then back to our cottage for another loving night. Yes, once upon a memory, no two mortals happier than we. As we ran across the seashells on the sand dunes by the sea, The same moon lights the world, yet a light that does not touch us all. Only those who raise the roses that climb against the wall. This next poem is called The Pebble. Oh, bring me back as a pebble on your shore, bathed in surf and sun and starlight, and flung by wave and wind, that I might knock again upon your door, at the cottage set beside the ever-giving sea, where once I loved you and you loved me, where seated within and reading now by the lamp, you wonder at the force of stormy night that hurled a pebble with such might that from the ocean it flew free and struck the door of memory as the wild wind cried, "It's me, it's me." Here's a little humorous poem about one of my favorite.
Hello, are you still there, Sherwood?
I don't hear anything either, Chuck.
I think his phone dropped off. I'm calling him back, Mike.
Hello?
Hi, Sherwood. Your phone dropped out just as you were going into that last poem.
The Conservatives Lament.
You said there was it was kind of humorous, I think.
Right. Conservatives Lament. Okay, I'll start again.
Great, thank you.
When a conservative gets in trouble and he does things to make one blush, like doctors shopping 2,000 pills to give his brain a little rush. When the state's attorney wants to prosecute, what's a poor millionaire to do? If your name is Rush and you want to save your tush, you cry, "Help me, ACLU. Yeah, help me, ACLU. I'm coming round to see your point of view. Forget all the hateful things I said that every liberal should drop dead. You know, I didn't mean it about you. Oh, yeah. Help me, ACLU. You guys are truly red, white, and blue. Hey, it's more fun than laughing gas to watch Rush try to save his ass. So help him, ACLU. I mean that. You need help, Rush. Get his, keep his medical records from public view. And you know, Rush, don't panic. We've always known why you sound manic. So help him, ACLU. You know, seriously, I love listening to Rush Limbaugh. The man, he's always got the inside dope. Oh, and by the way, who was it back in 1995 who said, and I quote, "Too many whites are getting away with drug use. The answer is to go out and find the ones who are getting away with it, convict them, and send them up the river, too." Well, Rush, I hope you can swim. So, that covers a lot of poetry for tonight. Maybe I'll close with this last one called "We're Americans." We don't believe in treaties. We don't believe in rules. Other people on this planet are just a bunch of fools. If we don't like your leader, we'll stick it in his face. We can wipe out any country because we're the master erase. Yeah, we're Americans. We're Americans. Say hey for the U.S. of A. We're Americans. We kill people for their own good every day. Libya, Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq. Where do you look? I think 13 countries are going at it.
Sherwood, that's the end of our segment, but thank you so much. We really appreciate you being with us at the beginning of every month.
Thank you, Chuck. Enjoy it.
And now, from Port Orange, Florida, with stops at Information Clearinghouse, Dandelion Salad, Nation of Change, World News Trust, and many others, here is Phil Ferrugio with It's the Empire, Stupid.
Okay, we have the Kentucky Derby coming up on Saturday, so this is horse race to the bottom. Okay, forget the upcoming Kentucky Derby. We now have the beginning of the premier horse race in America, the 2016 presidential race. Yes, it is fast approaching. This one of the many fabulous four-year events that consume most Americans, helped along by our bought and paid for mainstream media, overselling it, us on it. No need to remember how the two-party, too-big-to-fail bailout has left more and more homes still underwater or in foreclosure, while profits for the big banks and Wall Street firms mount. Who cares that hedge fund and junk fund, isn't that the same thing? Top executives earn tens of hundreds of millions a year, while many 9-to-5 working stiffs struggle to earn a measly $10 or even $15 an hour. Who cares that over 50% of our tax dollars goes to subsidize the military-industrial complex with our phony wars and occupations, replete with over 1,000 U.S. bases worldwide, while our state and city governments are running on deficits? Guess what? Miss Hillary could not care less. Marco, the new blood Republican Rubio, doesn't. How about Mr. Libertarian Less Government Rand Paul stating when he announced his candidacy that he plans to increase the military spending to fight the good fight against those crazy Arabs? His dad sat on stage in support of him, the same Ron Paul who railed for decades against big military budgets and foreign interventions. Go figure. Just wait till the rest of the so-called field of hypocrites and lackeys for this empire throw their hats into the ring. Sadly, many folks we all know will still support a lesser of two evils candidate when the smoke clears. I love how supporters of Miss Hillary from those so-called progressive women's groups think that she is the one to help women. Duh. When she triumphantly supported the NATO, translated U.S., carpet bombing campaign in Libya. How many women were slaughtered by those smart bombs? Or her advocacy for the thousands of drone missiles that once again destroyed the lives of mothers and their little children. Then we have the little punk Rubio, too chicken himself to sign up and serve when we illegally attacked and occupied Iraq and Afghanistan, yet loves to talk tough on using poor Latino, black, and white kids in uniform to patrol, occupy, kill, or be killed in the Middle East, or his love of, quote, family values, the Republican calling card, while the majority of his constituents have no government safety net due to the cuts that he supported. Yes, he, along with Miss Hillary and all the two-party con men and women, care not about the credit card companies who screw us with outrageous interest rates, or that millions of working stiff homeowners are still underwater in their home equity. What a joke. So, dear friends, the time has come to say no to the two-party-sponsored horse race. Support independent candidates, or simply leave the space blank like I do when you go into the voting booth. And you should never give up your right to vote. Please get out there in town squares, street corners, or anywhere in public and let your voice be heard. It was Ben Franklin who instructed folks who cared about their nation that dissent is the lifeblood of democracy. And finally, remember the words of the great scholar Frederick Douglass. Power concedes nothing without demand. It never has. It never will. End thereof.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. From the Nuclear Resistor, nukeresistor.org. Arrests as climate activists confront Finland's latest nuclear project. Nuclear abolitionists block doors to U.S. mission to the UN, 22 arrested. 16 arrested stopping traffic at busy main gate of California drone base.
Man arrested for landing nuclear protest drone on residence of Japan's prime minister. Climate activists arrested on Earth Day at Pentagon. Making history and building a future in the Nevada desert. Fastlane nuclear weapons base day-long blockade results in 34 arrests. Workers sent home. My 5 days in Pod A at the Juneau County Jail. 22 nuclear abolition activists walked into nuclear weapons site were arrested. These stories and more in the newest edition of the Nuclear Resistor online at nukeresistor.org. Since 1980, the Nuclear Resistor has provided comprehensive reporting on arrests for anti-nuclear civil resistance in the United States with an emphasis on providing support for the women and men jailed for these actions. And now from Citizens for Legitimate Government. Texas police were warned about ISIS attack 2 days before deadly shootout by anonymous activists. An activist linked to the International Hackers Collective Anonymous tipped off police in Garland, Texas about an imminent attack on an anti-Islam event 2 days before it happened, but the red flag went unnoticed. Police and the FBI say Elton Simpson, 30, and his roommate, 34-year-old Nadir Sufi from Phoenix, Arizona, opened fire Sunday evening on an unarmed security guard outside a contest featuring cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. The Daily Dot reported Monday that the Garland Police Department had received advance warning of the attack 2 days earlier, courtesy of a woman living outside the U.S. who has identified herself as an affiliate of the Anonymous Network. Other headlines, NATO and allies stage 1,000-strong drills across Europe. Top Iranian general, America was behind the 9/11 attacks. U.S.-led airstrike in Syria kills 52 civilians, including 7 children. Death toll continues to rise. And radioactive water leaks from storage tank at Fukushima. Find the Citizens for Legitimate Government is online at clg.org.
And this from InfoWars. The Ad Council has responded to concerns about a bizarre PSA it created in partnership with AARP. Features a news broadcast reporting on the announcement of martial law following nationwide riots. The commercial, which promotes the Ad Council's caregiver assistance program, includes the background audio of a TV news anchor announcing riots nationwide have prompted local governments to declare martial law. The president is asking that citizens find safety and remain calm. Authorities are working to contain the outbreak. The audio cannot be picked up consciously and is only heard with the volume turned up. After numerous people contacted the Ad Council on Twitter asking for an explanation, the organization published the following response. We appreciate those of you who have taken the time to voice your concerns about our caregivers' assistance. Concerns about the background audio file. Our pro bono ad agency who created this video used a pre-existing fictional vintage audio file as ambient background noise to invoke an earlier era. It was not intended to provide any additional messaging or for any additional purpose. The note goes on to apologize for any confusion surrounding the video. Why the Ad Council's commercial agency would choose to create a clip announcing martial law after nationwide riots and use it in the context of a serene. The Ad Council's explanation that the vintage audio was intended to invoke an earlier era also fails a logic test. Been no earlier era in the United States where martial law was declared after nationwide riots. This is very much a contemporary concern given the aftermath in Ferguson, Missouri, and what happened this week in Baltimore. One of the main reasons people were so creeped out by the PSA in the first place is the fact that the Ad Council act as a virtual public relations front for the U.S. government. Virtual public relations front for the U.S. government.
So that's it, folks. Our next guest of the evening is Mickey Z. Mickey Zesma was born and raised in Astoria, Queens, has appeared in a book with Noam Chomsky and in a martial arts film with Billy Banks. With only a high school diploma, he has authored 12 books and has spoken and lectured in venues ranging from MIT to ABC No Rio, from Yale University to Occupy University.
It's May, and that means it's another new month, and it's time to welcome Mickey Z from Astoria, New York City. Welcome to the show, Mickey.
Thank you, Chuck. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. So the temperatures are getting better. Are people getting out on the streets now or doing some activism?
It seems like it. It feels like it's been a long winter here in New York, extreme weather, and kind of put a lot of stuff on hold, as you and I have discussed before. But in the past 3 weeks or so, there's been a slow increase of people hitting the streets, a combination of there's a movement nationwide called Fight for 15 related to minimum wage workers going for $15 an hour. So there was something really big on April 15th, and there will be something coming up very soon. And there's been in light of the events in Baltimore, the Black Lives Matter protests in New York have picked up, as have the police brutality and arrests in response to it. And May 1st, of course, was May Day, which I went to some events here in New York City, and I'm not happy to report that it just seemed less attended than usual. And in many cases, I had this kind of foreboding sense of deja vu that it was, having gone to so many May Day events here, sort of the same faces in the same places. So maybe that's maybe that particular style of protesting has become stale. So I'm curious to see who picks up the mantle and comes up with some new ideas.
I kind of have the feeling that instead of protesting on May Day, people are celebrating on Cinco de Mayo.
That's possible. And I think a lot of people have lost touch, to what May Day represents. And in New York, it's a unique scenario because there's so many people crowded into such a small area, and it has such a history related to activism. So there are a lot of groups. Many of them are sectarian. They will not work with other groups. And so you show up in a park like Union Square Park, which is a traditional meeting place on May Day, and you sort of see the usual suspects sitting at their tables. What I find frustrating is that I could look at the photos I've taken last year at May Day, and if I posted them on social media and claimed that it was this year, I don't think anyone would, outside of references to Black Lives Matter, I don't think anyone would have said, would have caught me. Like, it's sort of the same thing. So I think that particular style, as someone who's trying to document and just be a good ally, I'm sort of in a state right now of searching to see where I could fit in and what feels effective.
You know, it's funny you should mention, putting up the wrong photos and nobody noticing. I remember reading last week about it, that some news station had put up photos of a riot in Brazil and claimed it was the Baltimore, with what was going on in Baltimore Live.
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, I certainly wouldn't do it for such Machiavellian reasons, but
well, of course not.
It's just going to show you so out of touch the corporate media is. In fact, I saw that somebody from CNN went to a town hall meeting in Baltimore a few days after the primary riots, and there were some people sitting in the crowd wearing matching colors, which happened to be red, but they were people from a local sorority. And CNN reported that they were gang members, because I guess in the mind of the corporate media, if you have a group of black people wearing similar clothes in the same place, the only thing they could be is gang leaders.
Interesting
and frightening and instructive to see how the corporate media sets the agenda. And I guess when you work within the corporate media, you internalize these values. That if you walk into a room and see a group of black people all wearing red, you make these assumptions based on the values that you've internalized.
That's exactly so. It's frightening, the stereotypes that we create or that are created for us.
Yep. In many cases, I think ultimately that's one of the most important jobs that white activists could do, is to challenge and educate themselves as to how the narrative is being being basically conditioned inside us. You know, if we even radical white people, needless to say, are more than capable of falling into the trap of the corporate media narrative. And and it's not the job of the people of color to educate white activists. We have to educate ourselves and find out what's really going on the ground and do our best to support it. So I think each time there's a situation, last year being Ferguson, this year already Baltimore, who knows? I mean, we haven't gotten into the hot days of summer where who knows where there's going to be. You know there's going to be something else because the militarized police are going to continue doing what they're doing until somebody stops them. And so I think it's crucial, absolutely crucial for non-African-American activists to figure out how each of us can be the best possible ally and support this powerful and necessary movement.
That's absolutely true. And it's so important that we all work together.
Yep. And from my perspective, as somebody that gets asked to be on radio shows and do talks and writes a lot of articles, part of working together for me is to not allow my voice to drown out other people's voices, because I have a platform which in some part is due to the work I've done over the years, but in large part is due to the fact that I'm also of a demographic, white male, that tends to be listened to more. And I'll tell you a quick anecdote. I went, since we last spoke, I went to a Black Lives Matter event in, I believe it was April 14th, and it was sort of the return of the movement. It was before the incident in Baltimore. And so I walked into Union Square Park, and it was a pretty good turnout for a Tuesday afternoon. High school kids were encouraged to walk out and join, and some did. And as I said, they were the usual suspects and all. And there were speakers on stage, and I'm looking up on stage, and at least half of the speakers, if not more, were white. And so I was with somebody who was a person of color, and she and I were commenting on this. And then somebody in the crowd recognized me as a writer and so on, that I've been on their show before. And he called me over and asked me if I wanted to, he had his camera. He said, "You want to talk for 5 minutes?" And frighteningly, my first reaction, having just stood there in the crowd commenting, look at all these white people talking at a Black Lives Matter event. My first reaction was like, he said, "Do you want to talk?" And my voice like, how long would it be for? Like, I was sort of saying yes, as long as it wasn't going to be very long, because I wanted to move around. And thankfully, the person I was with him and sort of gave me a nudge, and I realized what I was doing. Like, there I was falling right into the trap of allowing my voice to take up space where we need new voices. So I declined. I didn't do the interview, and I continued walking around taking photos, which I felt, when I share those photos, would be a better way for me to show solidarity and show people that follow me on social media what was happening in New York, as opposed to me blah, blah, blahing on a TV station when I encouraged the person who asked me, "Do you want to do the interview?" I pointed them to people who would know a lot more than me, because they're living this experience. So it was quite a wake-up call on many levels there, because first, witnessing the white speakers on stage, secondly, then immediately being asked and almost reflexively doing it, which I had to call myself out on, and then pondering it afterwards, saying like, well, what else could I be doing? Because I like sharing my opinions, but there comes a point where you become one of the usual suspects, which is not what I want to do.
Well, I think that's really cool that you decided not to speak at that particular one, although someone could say, oh, well, see, Mickey Z didn't want to speak, and so that must not have been a very good rally.
Yeah, I mean, I don't give myself that much credit for having that much credibility, but I really hope that, you know, I I was thankful that I had someone with me who encouraged me to see what was going on. And I really hope that people would, if they listen to this and consider that anecdote, not looking at it as like, oh, I'm some type of hero that I didn't do this. I'm pointing out that I came within an eyelash of doing it, because that's how heavily conditioned we are. It's like, oh, cool, this is what I do. I know all about Black Lives Matter, and I'm going to talk about it. So I'm the furthest thing from a hero in that. What I am is somebody that's continuing to trying to evolve in terms of like how I use the platform that I've worked to develop. And so, it's interesting because if folks go to World News Trust website that I write for on a regular basis, sort of inspired by this whole thing, I just recently posted a so-called article. And the reason I say so-called is that the name of the article, and I may be even paraphrasing myself here, is as a white writer, here is everything of value I have to add to the Black Lives Matter discussion. That's the long title. But when you click on the link and go to the article, it's blank. And so it's almost like, to me, a form of performance art where I'm just saying, I don't know what you were expecting to get out of this, but it was this idea that I'm questioning myself, and I hope people that go to World News Trust and click on the article and all the other great articles on World News Trust. But in this particular article, it might encourage people to consider how this works, how in a white supremacist culture, certain voices are heard more often and are louder and are more valued. And even if you have the greatest of intentions, sometimes you are drowning out someone who has a lot more valuable stuff to say. So I'm kind of in this midst right now of pondering this frame of mind that I'm in, and trying to figure out where I can bring my gifts and skills and be the most useful, but simultaneously the best possible ally in all these struggles against oppression.
Well, as we wind down, I think we're already already over our time, but I really like the idea that you are evolving your activism by involving participation of others.
Thank you. Yeah, that's sort of what I do. And if people follow me on World News Trust, what they'll see is my next goal is to find folks to interview. So I have this space that I'm fortunate to have on World News Trust. So as often as possible, I want to interview others and give their voice space in this place that I have people following my work. So I encourage anyone listening to visit World News Trust and not only check out my stuff, but everything that's happening on that site.
We thank Mickey Z. We'll see him again next month.
B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. All we need is a 10 and a fiber, car and keys and a sober driver. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. We now join In Progress, another episode of the Wisconsin Daytime Drama Series, sponsored by the Wisconsin Arts Council, hoping you will contribute to their most recent fundraising attempt to get green and gold the recognition they deserve on the state flag, as well as designated summertime vestments for the Wisconsin Catholic Archdiocese of Green Bay. And now we bring you Straight Out of Kenosha. We find Curly talking to Hal the bartender during happy hour at American Legion Post 99. Hal is just now refilling the plastic peanut bowl.
Blitz, Hal.
Coming right up, Curly.
You know, Hal.
What's that, Curly?
Media and politicians used to call people like the man in the orange vest at Home Depot the traditional working class. They were the ones who came home from the Korean War and proudly built all those 1,100 square foot faux Cape Cod aluminum-sided bungalows across America. Now, those working people, both young and old, mostly whites with only a high school diploma, nameless, except for the most obviously worse off, but who do have a name, white trash. These are families with two working spouses, a couple of kids who in 2005 were still trying to crack 35,000, who still make up 24% of American workers, at least 35 million by the government's own count. To be white and poor or just making it is a paradox in America. Whites, especially white males, are supposed to have an advantage they exploit mercilessly, yet slightly over half of all the poor people in the United States are white. Poor whites outnumber all poor minorities combined. Black poverty consumes a larger percentage of black society, to be sure. That does not negate the fact that there are at least 19 million poor and working poor whites. Their numbers are growing.
You got that right, Curly. Here you go.
Poor is poor. Well, do you have to work for your poverty or not? Poor whites are the only group that's both growing in number and getting poorer. Everyone else pretty much stuck. Still, the myth of the power of white skin endures, and so does the unspoken belief that if a white person does not succeed, his or her lack of success can be due only to laziness. But just like black and Latino ghetto dwellers, poor laboring whites live within a dead-end social construction that all but guarantees failure.
Another one, Curly?
Nah. I gotta go, Hal. See you later, huh?
Hey, that's a 20. You want change, don't you?
Keep it, Hal.
Thanks, Curly. Join us next week for another Wisconsin daytime drama straight out of Kenosha. Sponsored by Cheesehead Earbuds, Beverly's Big Bratwurst, and Lake Lasota Mulch Beer. And now the New American Dream Real History Channel, sponsored by Artifact Ripped Up Jeans. They really look really, really old. We continue with letters from Father Larry Rosebaugh from El Salvador, 1986. Larry Rosebaugh was a United States priest, a member of the Order of the Oblates of Mary. He was from Appleton, Wisconsin. After teaching high school in Duluth, Minnesota and Chicago, he came to Milwaukee in 1968 and worked at Milwaukee's Casa Maria Hospitality House, a facility linked with the Catholic Worker Movement, which gives shelter to homeless families and women. He spent years in U.S. federal prisons for anti-war protests. He was a member of the Milwaukee 14, a group of peace activists who in September 1968 broke into Milwaukee draft board offices, removing and burning some of the files in a nearby park while holding a prayer service. Like most members of the Milwaukee 14, Rosebaugh served 20 months in prison for his action. But mainly he was a missionary, taking seriously the words of Jesus and the spirit of the gospel, spending your life and your energies with the poor of the world. Rosebaugh was murdered May 18, 2009 by masked gunmen in northern Guatemala. At the time of the attack, Rosebaugh was in a van with four other oblates who were headed to a meeting in Playa Grande, Guatemala. Another priest was wounded. While the attack was supposedly a carjacking, the killers escaped without taking the vehicle. But before that day, he did so many things. One of those things was to send back letters telling those of us in the U.S. about his work with the poor. This letter was from El Salvador during the 1980s, the very, very bad years.
El Salvador, spring 1987. Around Christmas, I wrote to you concerning my friend Benjamin, his life and work as a campesino. Some of the details in the life of a campesino in this part of El Salvador. I tried also to picture for you the military situation, only a brief and partial glimpse. In this letter, I will reflect about a family who lives within a stone's throw of the church. Hoping that in this reflection, a reality may be seen that speaks for literally thousands of families trying to survive these war torn. I first became aware of Vicente one Sunday morning, kneeling with three or four of his small children in a church pew before. Wasn't anything special about them caught my eye, only the fact that they may well be the only children accompanied by their father. Weeks to follow, I came to meet Vicente's wife, Bertha, and their other children. It became apparent, too, that this family was always together. a parish was asked to send as many married couples as possible to a retreat sponsored by the diocese. Asked Vicente and Bertha if they would be interested, and if so, send a lecture which would give the details of this retreat. They responded yes, without hesitation. Talk took place in our parish church after the Sunday. Following the gathering, Bertha invited me to eat with them in their home. In a block and a half from the church and behind some wooden fencing stood there. I went through the tattered gate. I saw two shelters, both of which were patched together by most anything that had been available at the time. A piece of tin, cardboard box, corn stalks. Originally, the land on which these two houses sat belonged to the church. It was used for families fleeing the war zone. But in recent years, this land has fallen into the hands of the powers that be, who in turn have ordered these remaining two families to leave. It's at this point that an adequate description of this family is difficult. Like families the world over, they struggle, possessed by a profound faith that lifts them up and carries them beyond what seems to be possible. To rise in the morning not knowing whether today there will be food on the table, not knowing if the river will provide a few fish or the woods enough kindling to fuel the fire. And about sickness, which takes one out of every 10 babies, and about schooling, which demands notebooks, pencils, and clothing. How did they make it, the family of Bertha and Vicente? Must live in the present. Not look back, doing the best they can under the circumstances. It seems they possess that compassionate heart that already has turned itself toward their God, living in the desert, but with their staff, which is ready always to strike the rocks and await the spring of water. Because they have done things together from the beginning, they make it from day to day. The four boys, ranging in age from 6 to 11, work in the campo with their father. Bertha Dolores, 9 years old, their only daughter, shares the daily chores with their mother. Up and down the steep hillside, 3 or 4 times a day, little time for mother and daughter to fret, barely enough time to teach. December through March was hard for the family. Though it's the time of the coffee harvest, Vicente was not able to buy the necessary tools and supplies to work the harvest. It was then that Bertha began thinking that either she or Vicente must go in search of work in San Salvador. Decided that Bertha would go, leaving Vicente alone with the children. Go in faith, all work out. Shortly before the time of her departure, an elderly couple came in search of a woman to work in their household. Bertha accepted. It meant working from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day, including Sunday, cooking, cleaning, washing clothes, and running errands. First 2 Sundays she worked, Bertha was permitted 2 hours free to attend. But for these 7 days a week work, she received 100 colones a month. That in dollars is about $20. The injustices involved are apparent. The woman is seen as a non-entity. To be happy, she's paid anything. The town has about 5,000 residents. Other 5,000 lying in the outlying village. Small rural populace considered to be out of the area of conflict. Learning, however, that there is little control, if any, of where the war is. What's been referred to as a tranquil place to be in a moment's notice could be in a rage of terror. Lately, we are hearing more mortar and artillery explosions. Word gets to us that some youth have been arrested in a we were warned not to go to a certain village on a pastoral visit. Too dangerous. by invitation from the people of such a dangerous location? Without incident. Vicente had come, saying that as a family they felt this was part of their call in living out the gospel. He would go in faith and without fear. We followed his inspiration. The entire village came for the mass. Men arriving on horseback, women carrying small children. Spirit of joy was in the air. The people told us it was the first time a mass was celebrated in their community. On Monday, March 30th, I went early by bus to San Salvador to renew my visa. Valerie and a friend from the U.S. were alone in the parish and hoped to have some free time to visit. However, at 8:30 a.m., they received word that a 13-year-old boy had been killed by a grenade explosion. No details accompanied the story. It was Sunday, March 29th, and we had gone to a small village an hour and a half by foot to celebrate Mass for two young men, brothers-in-law, who were murdered the week before. They'd been eating supper with the family of one of the men when two men entered the house, demanded that everyone present lie down on the floor. At that point in front of the family, the two men were shot in the head. Died instantly. Again, no details as to who shot the men or why. These events of the last 2 days to deal with, it would be hoped that nothing more would occur. But at 1:30 a.m. on Tuesday the 31st, Val and Karen were shaken in their beds. It wasn't another earthquake, as it occurred on October 12th in San Salvador. Now I was being awakened by a mortar attack. Sounds of machine gun fire everywhere. Nothing like this had occurred since 1984, but the people knew the sounds and responded spontaneously, gathering children and the elderly under tables, hoping to prevent them. The artillery and bombing continued on for 4 hours. When finally it ended, news trickled into the parish compound that at least one civilian was dead. No account was given as to whether military personnel was injured. Not a town that has known constant bombings on the civilians. Captured and tortured, as is the case in other communities throughout. But an attack such as this most recent one surfaces clearly and profoundly the reality that exists all Salvadorans. Go on. And must those who detest and suffer the consequences the most, the poor, have little or no voice in the direction of future of their country? More taxes imposed, more dollars sent by the Reagan administration to continue a war that keeps the poor scattered and divided, preventing the unity needed in order to build a better place for all to live. Many go richer through the misuse of U.S. funding. The corpses of the poor cry in union with the spirit of Monsignor Oscar Romero. Stop the oppression. Americans present in El Salvador, as citizens of the U.S., raised to believe that problems can be solved quickly and permanently if we know the right people and can afford the price. We are slowly coming to see another reality. The American way is not the way. Way of the poor, way of faith, knows no timetable, nor weighs facts and figures. The people, El Pueblo, who work the fetch the water, walk the hillside, know that to have a plentiful harvest, a better life for their children, is not something that can be calculated. Just as likely that there will be as many seasons without rainfall as with rainfall. Children born who will not see their first birthday. As those who will complete a second. There are no computers for the poor. No determined tomorrow. As the birthdays in Vicente is the world. Living in the present. For the present, trusting in a God that is revealing day to day an image of a people walking together, suffering, dying, resurrecting over and over again. 24th of March, Monsignor Oscar Romero resurrected in the hearts of Salvadorans everywhere. It is the commitment that Monsignor Romero called for and that continues to grow and express itself in action that therein lies the future hope of El. Long haul, but no longer than the next harvest. Sight.
This has been the New American Dream Real History Channel, sponsored by Artifact Ripped Up Jeans. They're really cool because they look really, really old. Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown at the end of the empire. Duluth is big burritos and apricot wheat beer at a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings, like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops, and it's adventure, and it's being able to be yourself, but Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling, brawls, Bigfoot, and ball games. It's laser tag, it's the bomb, it's the gold. We continue our story. We join Penny Jones and Fluff Dublin onto the cabin property where Fluff had placed his Bigfoot recorder the other night. And rather than Bigfoot, he had heard people's voices, like someone being hurt or worse. Now they are at the cabin and they are hearing things and seeing things, people and deer, most dead, tied to a rope line behind a cabin in the woods. Why?
Please. Penny Jones thought that's what she said. The rope line jumped up and down, surging as the woman twisted, ramming her fist into the ground, growling with saliva and whatever caught in the throat. Her ankles lashed to the line. Looked down the way to see if anyone was dashing back to find out about the goddamn bouncing rope. Penny crawled on his hands and knees, gun in one hand, knife in his mouth, to the edge of the brush, just as far as he could think about going. "I can't help," he hissed. "Please, please, yes, you can, you really can." Buff stuck his head out from behind the tree. That voice, he knew that voice. Penny parted the last of the bushes with a slow motion breaststroke. He stuck out his head. The young woman had blonde hair with a streak of red and one of blue. Even upside down, she was pretty. Frosty, the frost, Frosty Pine, earring in her nose. A guy would think that hurt. Buff dived onto his stomach and began swimming through the brush, making way too much noise. But that was Frosty Pine. He knew her from East High School. She was younger than him by a couple of years, but everyone knew the Pines. They were famous for speeches, American Idol, swimming and softball and hockey and skiing and singing, acting. Both were recruited by the U and USC, UCLA, NYU. They were the younger sisters of Sugar Pine, the absolute Northland's contribution to the wonders of the world. Daughters of Mr. and Mrs. Jack Pine, both legends of East, Lake Placid Games, University of Minnesota Duluth, College of St. Scholastica, the Marathon, the Minnesota State Legislature, the Old World Theater, and Carnegie Hall. They were as famous as the McNuggets and the Kennedys, just as dangerous, some said. Penny tried to get Buck to slow down. Their noggins popped out in the tree line like two heads in the jungle display cutout at the Rainforest Cafe at the MOA. "What's going on?" Penny hissed. "What happened?" said Buck. "I don't know," she said. "Can you get me down? Get me down now." "I don't know," said Buck. "Yes, we can," said Penny. "Is that you, Buck? Yeah, you know me? I've heard of you. You believe in Bigfoot." Buck blushed pink. Penny moved from his squat to his knees and place one hand on the clearing grass. Not so strange, actually, she said. They all held their breath and turned heads toward the cabin at the sound of voices. Car door slammed. A screen door slapped. A police radio crackled. They heard footsteps. They're coming, said Puff. That was the step, said Penny. Go, said Frosty. I'll be fine. Okay, said Puff. Hey, not that we won't see you again, but who killed Mary? No, said Penny. Shut the F up. We can do this. We're getting you out of this now. I could do this, she said. I'll be able to tell you about Mary. It's always about Mary, right? Penny elbowed Puff hard in his shoulder. Come back later. Just go, 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 you weirdo into the woods, wannabe douchebag sons of bitches, she is. Jesus, F you, bitch, Puff whispered. Puff's head disappeared from the brush. Penny heard him crawling away. Someone fired, then two more quick shots, almost together. Penny withdrew his head from the bushes, leaned against a tree, took his pistol in both hands, and aimed in the general direction of the cabin. I can still see you, she said. He let himself down to his stomach and crawled toward her, gun in one hand, knife in his teeth. He made it right up to her. Sweat poured up her face to the ground. Dirt packed her fingernails. Her pink t-shirt was bloody and dirty, her lips dry and bleeding. Don't do it, she said. Don't do it, she said.
That's the news from Duluth, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO, lone gunmen are about average.
And that's it for another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. We're sorry about the technical difficulties in a couple places, but we hope you enjoyed it anyway. And we hope you'll be back next week, same time, same place, 6 to 8 p.m. every Thursday, right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Thank you and good night, Mike.
And thanks to our guests, Phil Ferruccio, Sherwood Ross, Ole Demigard, Mickey Z. Also credit and thanks to Joe Badgett and Andrei Vilcek. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to theshow.newamericandream.info. And as always, as Chuck said, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. And so to good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Muhammad Atta. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.